I'm Dr. Vanessa Sinclair, an artist and psychoanalyst based in Sweden who works with people internationally, and this is episode 288 of Rendering Unconscious Podcast. My guest today is Dr. Klara Nakoska. She's here to talk about her new book, Early Women Psychoanalysts: History, Biography, and Contemporary Relevance. She is also the founding director of the International Association for Spielrein Studies. You can find links to this book and other resources, including the International Association for Spielrein Studies, in the show notes accompanying this episode and at renderingunconscious.org. Rendering Unconscious Podcast was awarded the 2023 Gradiva Award for Digital Media from the National Association for the Advancement of Psychoanalysis. Huge thanks to all the guests, patrons, community, listeners, and fans over the past 6 years. This is a wonderful accomplishment, and I'm so happy to have you all here with me. I've started a Patreon page solely for Rendering Unconscious Podcast. Join at patreon.com/renderingunconscious to support the podcast and receive exclusive content every week. If you prefer, you can also support Rendering Unconscious at Substack at vanessa23carl.substack.com or by making a donation. You can watch a video of this discussion at YouTube. Just search for Trapar Film's YouTube page. That's T-R-A-P-A-R-T Film at YouTube. Or click on the link in the show notes for this episode. Hi, Clara. I'm so glad to have you back on Rendering Unconscious.
Hi. Thank you for having me back.
I can't wait to hear all about your new book.
Thank you. Yeah, that's, I'm very excited about it. It just came out a week ago or so. Well, no, wow. it's almost been 2 weeks. So
it's brand new. So how did this book come about?
Well, it started with a conference. I remember we talked about it. I don't remember. We talked like 4 years ago or something. Maybe 3.5. And I remember we talked about the conference. So I'm the founding director of the International Association for Spielrein Studies, and with several other scholars who are on the board, like Adrian Harris, John Lohner, and Pamela Cooper-White, we started organizing a Spielrein conference, which was supposed to take place in April 2019. And then, of course, this did not happen. And we had to postpone, and we ended up postponing 3 times until I decided, okay, let's just have it online. But let's just do it, because, you know, everyone, there was so much going on still. And we just wanted to finally do it. But, you know, we had so many things scheduled that were in person, were going to happen in person. It was supposed to be a 3-day conference in Warsaw.
It looked amazing.
Yeah, thank you. I do think so. And I did put in a lot of work into organizing a lot of different partnerships and a lot of different events and, you know, launches, so even stuff like that. So anyway, we finally had it online. That was in April. So we actually had... At first, we had this shorter webinar in April 2020, which was a free webinar, and we had like around 350 participants, and we talked about Spielrein only. We had 4 presenters talking about Spielrein. And then we had the following April in 2023, we had the full-on conference, which was a paid event and it was much more specialized for scholars, psychoanalysts, artists, writers who were very much interested in Sabina Spierwein and other early female pioneers of psychoanalysis. And so for that conference, we, for the call for papers, we opened it to submissions that not only focus on Spierwein, but also other, as we called it, early female pioneers. And we received so many that we decided, we ended up having three separate panels about those other women, let me call it like that. And so the book, I can show you, I'm very proud of the cover because my entire family worked on the cover. So that's the cover. And so the book grew out of the conference. So we have two projects that grew out of the conference. The book has 13 chapters and discusses in detail the lives of 14 different female psychoanalysts, pioneers of psychoanalysis, including Spierwein. So we have one chapter about Spierwein, the first chapter, and then 12 more chapters about other women. So that was the beginning. The book grew out of that conference. And then this, we have another thing that came out of the conference. I'm working with American Imago as a guest editor on a special edition about Spierwein, special issue that will hopefully come out at the end of this year, maybe beginning of next year. We'll see about that.
Amazing. We've done so much to help promote Spierwein studies, and it's so fantastic. And I remember the conference, you had tours scheduled to go through the different areas that were relevant and all sorts of things. It really looked like a dream, but COVID, it just really stopped everything and messed up a lot. But I'm glad at least we have online so we could still get all the information out there to people and that it's able to come out in book form in this way. So you have one chapter on Spierwein. And who are the other women psychoanalysts? It's a really thick book.
Several of the chapters are based on presentations that were given at the conference, at the, as we call it, Spierwein conference in 2023. But I also reached out to several scholars, Polish scholars, who wrote about Polish female pioneers of psychoanalysis. And they typically already published in Poland, or maybe it was not even published in Polish. So these were some more contributions. So we have a number. I can go through the chapters.
Yeah.
So the idea was to choose women who were the least known, and that's the majority of them, who have not been published about in English, because the book is primarily intended for an English reader. It's in English, published in the UK and the US. So that was the main focus, and that's most of the women are women who I also haven't even heard about before the conference submissions or before I came across their names. And they're in publications by those specific scholars who managed to unearth archival documents, their birth certificates, and so on and so on, and piece together their story. So that's the majority of women. But a couple of those women that the book focuses on, like Sabina Spierwein, I think still, are women whose names are a little bit better known, I think, in a bit of a broader circles, maybe even a little bit outside of academia, but at least in academia and psychoanalytic circles, in medical circles, but who are still known inadequately, I would say, still known for not the right things, not what we would like them to be known for. So like Spierwein, I think predominantly is still this kind of pop icon, and she's still discussed in this context of relationship with Jung, or her being this victim in the triangle between Jung and Freud, being pulled, you know, by the two powerful men of psychoanalysis, being pulled kind of apart to their side, to side with one of them. The same applies to Lou Andreas Salomé, I think, who's still predominantly seen as this muse of Freud's, of Nietzsche's, of Rilke's, right? So again, we have those famous men and her somewhere there in the middle, typically objectified, victimized, and not seen as a psychoanalyst, as a scholar, as a theorist in her own right, in their own right, right? I'm talking more generally. Mm-hmm. So we have a chapter about Lou Andreas Salomé, about her theory of art and creativity, which is very interesting. So I feel like that's a name that's maybe better known, but not for what Shira wrote about. Mm-hmm. There's also, for example, Margareta Hilferding, who I also think is maybe better known, but she's typically known for this very fact that she was the first female member of the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society, right? So again, in this context, not necessarily for her personal life, so this is maybe a little better, but still she's just this first, right? She's this one woman who entered this all-male circle. And so this Candice wrote about her, about Margareta Hilferding's life as a women's rights activist too. She wrote about her theories about maternal instinct, which are very much ahead of her time, and I think still are very progressive. So we have those few women, and then we have some names that I think are probably not known at all. There's Beata Rank, who, well, actually also known probably as Otto Rank's wife.
Mm.
And just this, I think she's...
I didn't even know Otto Rank's wife was a psychoanalyst. So there you go.
She was. And, Lena Magnon, she did this huge research and found her birth certificate and corrected, for example, scholars that kept on repeating that Beata Rank was born in, I can't remember the year, but it made no sense. And Lena corrected it and said, well, it was actually a decade later. And she found a lot of information about her studies and found out that actually Beata Rank was not being truthful about her studies. And so, as you know, she looked into it and kind of, yeah, gleaned information from those bits and pieces and fragments. And so that's another chapter. There's a chapter about Tatiana Rosenthal, who's often linked to Spirin because she was also a Russian-born psychoanalyst who went back to Russia and died there in very different circumstances than Spirin. So this is a conversation with Leonid Kadis, who Pamela Cooper-White interviewed Leonid Kadis, who's this researcher who, again, you know, did this huge archival work to discover information about Tatiana Rosenthal. So it's a conversation with him about what he discovered. And then other contributions about other Polish psychoanalysts. So there's a chapter about Ludwika Karpińska-Wojczyńska, who is, I think, completely unknown, and not even in Poland, really. And she was the first woman to attend the meetings of the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society. But she was, you know, like all of them, she was a psychoanalyst in her own right, and she was a human being in her own right and had a whole story. So this is, again, two Polish researchers dug out information about her, did this huge, huge, huge archival research, and again, like pieced together, put together her biography, personal and professional, and her story. And there's and two more chapters that are about Polish women psychoanalysts. There's a story of Alberta Szalita, who another analyst, not really remembered, who lost her entire family in the Holocaust, mm-hmm. and then immigrated to the US and settled in New York and lived for 100 years. And then I wrote a chapter about Olga Wermer, another Polish analyst who immigrated fleeing Hitler, and she settled in Boston. Another chapter is about Eugenia Sokolnicka and Marie and Sophie Morgenstern, two Polish psychoanalysts who immigrated to Paris, both of them. Especially Sokolnicka is responsible really for bringing psychoanalysis to France. And then she was completely replaced by Marie Bonaparte and forgotten. There's a chapter, two chapters about Hungarian psychoanalysts. There were a lot of, I'm almost done. I'm trying to.
No, I love it.
Each of these chapters, just a tiny bit at least. So Anna Borgosz is a scholar who studies those early female psychoanalysts in Hungary. And she wrote a chapter about Vilma Kovács, but she also included shorter biographies of several other Hungarian female pioneers. And there's a chapter about Erzsébet Farkas, who was not a psychoanalyst per se, but she used psychoanalysis in her work with children. She was a director of a Jewish foster home in Europe, in Bekes, in Hungary. And two more, we have a chapter about Nick Wahl, who was one of only two of those women who were not Jewish. Nick Wahl, who helped get Jewish people out of Hungary, out of Norway. And then the last but not least is the story of Barbara Lowe, who was a pioneer in Great Britain, and also, again, like almost all of them, you know, either erased from history due to a combination of factors, not necessarily because someone decided to, right, but several factors combined worked toward that, or inadequately remembered just for bits and pieces of their theories or of their work, or because of their connection to, again, like one of the famous men. So yeah, each of those stories is different, but there's so many themes that are common to those stories. That's the book.
Yeah, that's so fantastic. I can't wait till it arrives. And I know there's another book. It might be by the same author that I ordered at the same time I ordered yours, that also came out from Routledge recently. It might have been last year, on like the Hungarian, like the Budapest School women psychoanalysts. I had heard about it from a previous guest that went to the Ferenczi like conference last summer. And I was like, oh, I have to find out about this and talk to her too.
Yes. Absolutely. I was looking because I had it here, but I think I put it away. That's Anna Borgosz. That's her book. That's a wonderful book. She focuses, like I said, I mentioned her before. She focuses on those of those women who are Hungarian, and she looks at this so-called Budapest School of psychoanalysis around Sándor Ferenczi. And at the reasons why there were so many women, there was this, you know, high representation of women in those early years of psychoanalysis there in Hungary, and what happened with them, and the socio-political situation that informed this possibility for them to enter, but then also shaped their lives in often very tragic ways. Yes, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I'm so glad that you're doing this work and helping these stories become more well known, because it's so important. And it's so unfortunate that they've been lost or repressed in history throughout time.
Yeah, yeah. And I started this work with Sabina Spielrein 15 years ago, I want to say. Wow. Maybe more, actually, even 20, no, 15, around 15. And I had no idea that there are so many, and that in a way, those stories are so parallel and their stories intersect. And those women were often friends, or they were, you know, each other's analysts and analysts, and their lives intersected, their paths intersected. I had no idea that there were so many of them. But also another thing that was surprising to me is that, well, they are often largely neglected. But at the same time, you know, if there's someone who decides and has the opportunity, has the means and so on to do the digging, it's there. It's often there. Their publications are there, or their papers about them, their personal, papers are there, their letters, their memoirs, their birth certificates and so on and so on and so on. So it's not like, I mean, maybe it's still kind of a choice to not have them in our collective memory and to have to dig them out and piece together and glean, you know, from whatever people can find. It's not, I did come across several names that when I tried digging into their stories, I couldn't really find information, but that's a very rare case. That's my experience only, but.
And you're a historian.
Well, I'm a culture historian. Mm-hmm. I'm a historian of women. I'm not a historian. Yeah.
Yeah, but so you know how to research.
I'm learning. I like it. I always liked it, you know. And everyone always says it's like being a detective, but it is true. It is true. And it can be very satisfying. You know, it's thrilling to find something no one has ever found before and hasn't looked and researched and studied before. And I find it very satisfying, and to be able to put some of those people erased for one reason or another, but, you know, people who belong to minority groups because they were women, because they were Jewish. In the case of my research that I've been working on for a couple of years here at New York, also immigrants. Mm-hmm. And to kind of put them back on the map, at least a little bit, at least for a small group of people initially, but then maybe more. That's very, it's just a good feeling.
No, it's great. It's really important work. How did you get interested in this in the first place?
It started with Spielrein for me. I was working on my PhD in Edinburgh, and I was using theories of feminist psychoanalysts like Luce Irigaray, Helen Sissou, and my supervisor at the time, Alexandra Smith, told me about Sabina Spielrein. And I was hooked pretty quickly. When I got my PhD, I kind of moved into from literature, which was my initial focus. I moved into history of female psychoanalysts. And I quickly discovered that basically all of them were Jewish, or almost all of them were Jewish. So that kind of is this field. It's like this complex field with different intersections of you know, women's studies, Jewish studies, psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. But I'm not a psychoanalyst myself. So for me, it's always I'm more interested in cultural history, personal history, in the stories of those women, of why they're forgotten and how. I'm mostly focused now on like memory and post-memory and how they talk about their experiences, how they talk about the losses, how they talk about survival, immigration, the Holocaust, and so on and so on, and how those stories are then retold by their children and grandchildren who I have that privilege that I can often interview. And talk to and find out, you know, were all those memories passed on to them, told to them, or like kind of silenced and muted very, very often out of the conversations, actually, and how they remember it, how they retell it. That's kind of what fascinates me most at the moment. So it was a long answer to your question. It started with Sabina Spielrein and her diaries for me, but then, you know, that was years ago. So it developed, it grew into where I am now with all those women who managed to immigrate, who managed to flee the Nazis to the US.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's amazing that you've been able to talk to their families.
Yeah, yes. That is, it's really interesting. And so, you know, not everyone wants to talk to me and not everyone is still around, unfortunately, but this is something I included in my chapter about Olga Vermeer for the book. I managed to talk to her two daughters and several other family members and add on to her story, but also just to see how they remember her. Look at that again, like memory, post-memory, right? How maybe trauma is transmitted or not into the younger generations. That's something that's interesting to me too, to take a look at that. And very often children of those psychoanalysts were actually psychoanalysts themselves or psychiatrists. So that's like this another level, another layer, a layer to look at. It's, yeah, I'm still in the research phase.
It sounds really interesting. When you're done with this project, you have to come back and talk about it again.
I'd love to, of course. I
mean, yeah, and you said you're interested in stories and the cultural history, but that's also what psychoanalysts are interested in, like getting people's stories and how they tell their stories and how they remember and, yeah, how trauma is passed down. So it's all very psychoanalytic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, you know, when I was working on the chapter about Judith Kestenberg, who was a Polish Jewish psychoanalyst who immigrated to New York and settled in New York. And she is unique in this group of women that I've been investigating in that she actually, in her work, she did deal with the Holocaust. So she started this, well, she started with first project, but then she moved on to, she had so many different projects, different types of project surrounding Holocaust survivors, especially those who were children, very young children, up to the age of, I think, 13 was her cutoff during the war and during Shoah. And she was interviewing them. She put together this whole group of people who were interviewing them, and they collected 1,500 testimonies overall. And she put together like different types of support groups and so on and so on. And that's very unusual. So that's something I discovered. I mean, I already knew a little bit of this because when I was digging into those other women, it was just interviews with them, some memoirs, some letters, and what their children, grandchildren remembered was that they would not talk about the past. They would not talk about, some of them wouldn't even talk about growing up in Poland or elsewhere in Europe studying, but sometimes they did, but then there was this moment when they would stop talking, right? Everything that had to do with the Holocaust, the loss, typically of their parents, other family members too, the loss of the whole culture, especially when we talk about Jewish women or Jewish people, right? This it's the end, the Holocaust really is the end of a certain era, right? There's barely any Jewish people left in Poland. So it's loss of culture, loss of homes, loss of language, because they immigrated to an English-speaking country, but they wouldn't talk about it. And typically what I saw from this is just, again, like just my research, just my experience, that grandchildren would very often keep asking and asking, like they really wanted to find out. And then sometimes they would break through that wall of silence. But so Judith Kesterberg was an exception in that she did talk about it, although in a quite limited way. And she seemed very protective of her past, very protective of the stories about her parents who both died in the Holocaust. They both were murdered. But she did start this quite new field, really. Like, it seems like she was really someone who started this field of looking into those who were children. She called them child survivors of the Holocaust. But yeah, that's something that I discovered, that there's so much silence and psychoanalysis. So this is kind of I'm kind of adding to what you said, is that up until like really late 60s, psychoanalysis was, and psychoanalysts were basically saying, no, let's not, from what we know, right? Because there's so much we don't know how work with patients went on because of privacy issues. But from what we know, it seems like there was the advice given to Holocaust survivors and to trauma survivors was move on. Don't talk about this. You know, you're starting anew. This is your new home. You know, you can reestablish yourself here in America and just move on. There was this wall of silence. Until like 68.
Maybe that was coming from a wish from like the analysts as well, like in the trauma that they had carried on, of like wishing that was true, that you could just kind of move on. That some people think too, that's why psychoanalysis has had this position for such a long time of like being kind of apolitical and not talking about the social so much and things like that. And then now there's this more movement to kind of shift that and show that, like, of course, like all these social dynamics and cultural dynamics are played out in people's, you know, individual lives and treatments, and you kind of can't escape it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's something we talked about before when we first talked, this transition, this political aspect, social aspect of psychoanalysis being lost in translation when it traveled from Europe, pre-war Europe to the US. That's something that I saw, that it was political. It was this political project, social project back in Europe. It was about the idea was to, for psychoanalysis, for therapy to be accessible to people. There were low fee clinics. There were patients were seen for free. That all got lost, right?
Yeah. So now that's starting to get, there's a movement towards reviving that again. So that's interesting that it's kind of coming back now.
Yeah, I feel like it's a part of a bigger way of thinking about the past too, and looking at, kind of looking at differences, exploring differences, pointing out differences, and not pretending we're all the same. We have the same circumstances, you know.
Yeah, making sure that other different points of view are being shown, rather than just this kind of one focused point of view, like you talked about with these women, where they're all in relation to these men that were well known, and then the women's position is just in relation to them or somehow in between them, you know. And that's happened to, of course, Black people, people of color, Indigenous people, gay people, queer people, trans people. So it's like, instead of everyone else, all of us being always in relation to this one point of view, now it's hopefully getting more diversified, and that there's like multiple points of views and ways of being that are all represented and not just revolving around this kind of one point. Mm-hmm. Or that the point believes it's revolving around this one point and has written history that way.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that one point wants us all to revolve around it, for sure. But yeah, I do feel, you know, there's a certain norm, right? The white male, heterosexual, able-bodied, blah, 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 norm. And then there's always everything in relation to that norm. And well, hopefully that's changing slowly, right? I mean, slowly. Hopefully it's changing.
Yeah.
It is. slowly.
I think so. I think there's a lot of pushback from the norm, but I think that there are so many others that are, there's so many more of the rest of us than those. Yeah. So hopefully the numbers can win out in the end.
Yeah. But you know, even when I was editing this book, to come back to the book for a second, I was thinking, oh my God, I wish I didn't have to write, she was the first woman to blah, 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 right? Because this is, again, in relation to men. Why do we have to point that out? But I decided, okay, maybe next book, I will cut it all out and just say, she did this, like this person did those things. But I feel like still there's a value, but it frustrates me. But I feel like there's still a value in saying, well, she was the first woman to get into that all male group, right? Or she had those ideas that then Freud, for example,
co-opted.
or he didn't acknowledge that he actually heard her talk about it 10 years prior. And he turned it into this, you know, famous book read by everyone. But that's, again, this kind of being in relation to the norm, right? That I felt that there's a need of pointing out she was the first woman to do this. Mm-hmm. But it worries me because I feel like when we say it, we kind of, it's almost like internalized misogyny. Like it's almost like this, I feel the need to point out that she was first, and it maybe like, I don't know. It's more like saying there only one woman on top. I don't know if you know what I mean. Maybe I'm going too far with this.
No, I think it's true. I think you're right that there's still a need for it in a way. But that's frustrating because it would be nice if we were at a point where we didn't have to constantly point that out in relation to.
Yeah. And another thing, and it also adds to this, the norm, I feel like every time, you know, we say first woman, we kind of use the binary, right? Mm-hmm. Again. So, yeah, but that's what it is for now, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully shipping, maybe next book, like you said. Okay, we can keep pushing it a little bit and a little bit more until people will be, they won't even remember when it was done against the norm. When everyone was compared to the norm. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, but that's the question, right? Do we push it bit by bit or do we blow it up?
That's true.
I would love to blow it up, but that's,
We're trying.
But for now, have a book out.
It's a really great book. It looks really wonderful and I can't wait to read it. And I can't wait to see what else you do. Is there anything else going with Shibulrein Studies Association now or?
Maybe.
To be continued.
There are some ideas, there are some plans. We might be collaborating on some projects, some events, but I'm kind of slowly coming up. You know, the conference, it took so many years because of all the postponements, and each postponement meant a lot of work into like reformatting the whole thing and figuring out, you know, how do I do it if it's still in person, but a year from now, or how do I do it when now it's in, now it's remote, and so on and so on. So, and then right after the conference ended, we had the call for papers and the book just came out. I'm only slowly coming out of that process, but I would love a conference. And I started talking with Adrian Harris about it. Just the first conversation for now, but I can still tease it a little bit. A conference about female psychoanalysts, the early female psychoanalysts.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Shibulrein. That's an idea, but I don't think I'm going to plan a huge 3-day conference anymore.
It's so much work.
it was a lot of work, and then, you know, it never happened. So it was, yeah, again, very frustrating, but a long time ago too. But I think smaller events, maybe. Yeah. So,
and if you ever want to have like an online discussion where it's just like a few people talking, we could always do a podcast like that. If you want to just like have a group chat from people like from the book or something like that, we could do something like that in the meantime if you want.
Sure. Yeah.
That could be fun. And they can all talk together and about their different people. And people can join the Spear Wine Association and support.
Of course. Yes. Yes, we have a website. It's www.spielreinassociation.org. And of course, membership is open to everyone who has contributed or is planning on contributing to Spielrein studies, anything that has to do with Sabina Spielrein, or also anyone who hasn't contributed yet but is supportive of the cause. We have 50 members exactly today.
Very nice. I'm a member.
Yay. yeah, 50 members from, I think, like 19 different countries or something like
that. Very cool.
That was one of the ideas we had, is to bring people together, to connect people. And I know that some cooperations came out of it. People who met through the Spielrein Association, published papers together and had conversations and had, you know, exchanged emails and ideas. I would like to have more happening, but, you know, we are a niche association. So, and there's a lot of organization that goes into planning events. So, but there's definitely something will definitely be happening.
Absolutely. No, and like you said, this COVID, I mean, like you said, the conference was a long time ago, or was supposed to be, but this COVID time is so strange. You know, it's like, I feel like 2019, like pre-COVID, seems like eons ago. Like, I actually haven't been back to the US since 2019. I'm coming in May to New York because I've been invited to be a part of this Otto Ronk conference, which is interesting. I've been reading everything about Ronk, and I have not come across his wife, the psychoanalyst. But anyway, I've been reading about him for like months. So that just goes to the point of all of this. But yeah, it made me realize, like, well, I haven't actually been back to the US since 2019. I haven't been back to New York since 2018. And it feels like ages ago, but like 2020 till now, it seems like, I mean, it seems like all like yesterday. It's like such a condensed period of time, at least for me, that it just feels like it's gone by so quickly in a strange way.
For sure. Yes. it's a loop. And then it's, yeah, when I sometimes think that I've been here, because I've been, you know, I came to the US 6 months before COVID.
Wow.
So my entire life in the US basically was affected in one way or another by the pandemic, because it still is. You know, it's still happening. Things are still happening. It's not like we're over, you know, back to normal, whatever that was.
Yeah, I don't think that's ever going to happen. I feel like someone said that, like, I thought of it this way, like the new BC, instead of it being like before Christ and after death, it's like the BC is before COVID. Like, we have before COVID era, and then we have since COVID. We're like living in a different reality.
Yeah, and then there's also COVID time is, for me, is like before vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then after vaccine, right? There's this period very different before people got vaccinated, like, well, I mean, we did very quickly, but and then this opened some opportunities and possibilities of meeting with people, and schools reopened. And so that was a big deal for me, because I was, you know, I was with two.
Right. Kids. You have your children. Oh, my gosh. That must have been so much work. I can't even imagine. I was thinking of everyone like working from home all of a sudden, and then having to like homeschool their kids. And oh, my gosh. And yeah, then you were dealing with all that with the conference.
Yeah, it was insane.
It's a lot.
Yeah, but I, you know, I sometimes feel overwhelmed with whatever's happening in my life, and I think, well, I survived this. I survived COVID with, you know, a 3-year-old and a 7-year-old. Wow. Four and seven. Homeschooling, work, like we had a 1-bedroom apartment, you know.
I had friends that have patients, like analyst friends that lived in like a studio apartment with their partner that said they had to do their sessions like in the bathroom.
Yeah. We use the bathroom for things too. Yeah.
It was wild times, but it still is wild times. But but anyway, you are a very strong woman and you're bringing very strong women to the fore. And that's a wonderful thing. And anytime you have a new thing to talk about, you're always welcome on the podcast.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Of course.
I am working on a book about this amazing psychoanalyst too, so I might come back with that. I'm actually quite advanced in that project. Her name was Clara Happel. She was an amazing person. And again, one of those who were basically forgotten, I think. She was a first generation analyst, and she was German, lived in Berlin, but then, for example, went to first Frankfurt and then Hamburg, and started in Frankfurt. She started a society, and then in Hamburg, psychotic society, and then in Hamburg, a study group, and then immigrated to the US and settled in Detroit, which was, she did that to spread psychoanalysis, but it was a very unwelcoming place to be, to say the least. It was very racist and anti-Semitic and very lonely. She was really isolated. She was arrested by the FBI. Hmm. I had this huge FBI file that I managed to get, which I'm very grateful for, because initially when I asked under FOIA, they told me 38 months. So
but
she was incredibly progressive. She was an anti-Hitler activist. She was a social feminist. She was a women's rights activist. And so this is someone I'm writing a whole book about her story, and I'm going to write a little bit about my own story too, and my grandmother, whose name was also Clara.
Oh, wonderful. So
it's going to be a little bit personal.
Wonderful. I love it. Well, I can't wait to read that when that's out and have you back.
Thank you. Yeah. I'll let you know when I'm ready.
Is there anything else you wanted to be sure to mention before we wrap up?
I don't know. maybe if you're interested in Sabina Spielrein, visit our website. We have a lot of information there, a lot of links. We have a whole database, a library of publications about her. We have a tab with events and recent publications. We have links to webinars and meetings and conversations. So I think that, and I'm trying to update it at as much as possible and include everything I come across that relates to Sabina Spielrein. So I would just say, you know, if you're interested more in her, I think this is the main source of information, our website. That's one thing. And if you're interested in female psychoanalysts, I'd say buy the book. I don't know.
Absolutely.
Very modestly.
No, we are all about promotion here. I figure if advertising companies can market to everyone the way they do and listen in on our phone calls and things to sell us stuff on Instagram, then we can promote good books. Shamelessly.
I mean, I have to say, I am really proud of that book. I think all those chapters have been beautifully written, are super informative. And maybe last thing I would actually like to say is that my idea behind this book was that it was accessible to general readership. I didn't want a book that was targeted at psychoanalysts. Like I said, I'm not even a psychoanalyst myself. So I asked all of my contributors to try to focus or try to include at least biographies of those women, experiences, information about upbringing, the socioeconomic, sociopolitical context, historical context, just to tell their stories, stories of immigration, if there was immigration, stories of entering the psychoanalytic movement, but not focus on their theories as much. And when I edited the chapters, I tried to edit those parts down a little bit. Because some of the contributors are psychoanalysts, so they naturally focus more on, you know, what's of interest to them. But I did edit those parts down a little bit, and I try to make it more as accessible as possible. So I do think that this book is for anyone who's interested in women's history, a little bit of gender studies, Jewish studies, and history of psychoanalysis. But I think the least in a way, not as much. I really try to make it, I don't know, a good read, I would say.
Exactly.
Narrative nonfiction almost, but I mean, that's not what it is, but that's what I had in mind. So that's, I think that could be my final words. You don't have to have any psychoanalytic knowledge to read those chapters, maybe a couple of them a little bit, maybe, you know, but generally speaking, that's not required to enjoy this book.
Wonderful. And that's good to know. And I love the kind of cross-pollination of the fields as well.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I do too.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Clara.
Thank you for inviting me, really. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Rendering Unconscious. You've just heard a discussion with Dr. Clara Nakoshka. Be sure to check out her new book, Early Women Psychoanalysts, History, Biography, and Contemporary Relevance, from Routledge. As per a suggestion from a listener Rendering Unconscious, I did join the Amazon Affiliates program. So if you are going to order this book and you're going to order it from Amazon anyway, why not go to the link accompanying this episode or renderingunconscious.org and click on the link for the book there. That way the podcast gets like 50 cents or something. Every little bit counts. Thank you for your support. You can follow Rendering Unconscious at Instagram at Rendering Unconscious and at TikTok, also at Rendering Unconscious. Be sure to check out our previous episode, Rendering Unconscious number 107. And now the song, Woman of the Year, from an album I did with UK Sonic Mastermind, Pete Murphy. Enjoy.
Woman of the Year. 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 Yeah, Woman of the Year. 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 Woman of the Year.
Freud believes that the bond which integrates individuals into a mass is of a libidinal nature.